You think we're simple, you think we're not bright. Look at your cities and ask yourself who's right. We've got country and you've got crime. We've got green and you've got grime. Let there be no doubt, we have what it takes to till the soil until our back aches. Just give us a break and don't be so rude. We love the work and you love the food. We feed you.
Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission. Welcome to the Wheat All About It podcast. Wheat is a miracle plant, and if you're interested in wheat and the forces that affect the wheat industry, then you've come to the right place. Wheat All About It includes interviews, presentations, and yes, even my own musings about our favorite crop. And please visit our Facebook page where I will post items including photographs of speakers, PowerPoint slides from presentations, as well as information about contests. Search for Wheat All About It. Here we are at episode 7, or what I'm calling, Don't Forget, Wheat is Food. This podcast features two men who might otherwise never meet owing to their different positions as links in the grain chain, not to mention the different meetings they attend. I start off with Tim O'Connor, president of the Wheat Foods Council, a group that promotes wheat and wheat products to various influencers within the U.S. Sean Campbell, deputy director of the Portland office of U.S. Wheat Associates, is up next. He brings us up to date on hard white wheat, the class I like to call the Little Red Engine, because its backers continue to say, I think I can, when it comes to one day growing exportable quantities. As different as the job descriptions of these two men are, their mission is really not all that different, and it's why I have them sharing episode 7. See if you can spot the commonality. Listen all the way through. I'll spell out what I'm thinking. One of the line items in the Washington Grain Commission budget is $54,830 for an organization called the Wheat Foods Council. Tim O'Connor has been president of the organization for the last year and a half. I caught up with him at a communications meeting that was being held prior to the Wheat Foods Council annual meeting in Scottsdale, Arizona. I asked O'Connor to describe the Wheat Foods Council origin and purpose.
So the Wheat Foods Council was created in 1972 by state wheat commissions who felt that domestic demand for wheat was not where it should be, and they wanted to put together a marketing program that would help build demand for wheat foods, wheat products here in the U.S. And so it originally started as the state wheat commissions coming together and creating the organization. And over time, it's extended a bit into the value chain. There are millers, there are bakers, and others in the value chain who have joined in, but it still remains at the core the state wheat commissions that are the bulk of our board members, the bulk of our funding, and the ones who really see a huge value in, you know, building domestic demand for wheat products.
The Wheat Foods Council has been fighting gluten-free for the last 8 years or so. Have we reached peak gluten, or does it continue to be the number one issue confronting wheat farmers, among others?
Well, I declared a year ago, Scott, that we'd reached the tipping point. I've worked in the food industry for a long time. I've worked for the beef industry, for the potato industry. I've seen the low cholesterol, the low fat, the low carb diets. They all perform very similarly as fad diets, that there's a rush where the media finds the fad diet sexy. And that's what they want to cover. And the more they cover it, the more other members of the media cover it. And it becomes an onslaught. And what's really added to the gluten-free fad diet was social media that didn't exist back in the 80s when the low cholesterol diets were in vogue. The media was all over those, but there wasn't the social media to build a secondary wave on it. And when I say I declared in January of 2016 that we'd reached a tipping point, it's that same media that had been promoting the diet was now questioning the diet. And the volume of stories that were being placed in traditional mainstream media was really declining. And the ones that were there were the ones that were beginning to question. Once you reach that tipping point where the media is no longer a proponent and actually becoming an opponent, that's when fad diets start to sink under their own weight, because they always promise something they can't literally achieve. People jump on the bandwagon because of the promise. You know, the low-carb diet was the promise of you could eat the bacon and wear the bikini. And who doesn't want that? But the, you know, the thing that's also unique about the gluten-free phase in this diet regime is the promise of better health, the promise of no more brain fog, the promise of all these things that people have almost concocted and blamed on wheat, has given a rise to a belief that, well, it's because I'm eating the wheat foods. That's what's doing it. And if I just quit eating those, I'll feel better, I'll look better, I'll lose weight, my life will be different. And the reality is that's only true for people who truly have celiac disease. The rest of the folks are working through a lifestyle situation that they are wanting an easy answer for, and there's not easy answers. If there were, some fad diet would have caught on, solved the world's problems, and it would no longer be a fad. It would be the thing. And that's not what happens. It's too complicated.
There are many differentiations of wheat. For instance, there's six classes of wheat grown in the U.S. But in terms of flour, there are two main types, enriched, or what is also called refined flour, and whole grain flour. What's the Wheat Foods Council position on these two different types of flour?
Well, our position is very straightforward. This is what the industry produces. We have all those products in our portfolio. In fact, when I arrived at the Wheat Foods Council, we went through a strategic planning process, because as a candidate for the position to replace Judy when she retired, I discussed with the leadership during the selection process. I thought the Wheat Foods Council's strategy was a little bit narrow. It's a budget question of how broad to go, but I felt it was too narrow. And we did broaden it a bit and change it a bit, and I'm happy about that. And one of the questions that we asked the industry was this very one. You know, whole grains really have a lot of momentum, and for good reason. But as we talk to the industry, you know, it's clear that a big portion of what we produce today still gets sold in the enriched or refined grain category. It's, depending on who you talk to, at least 80% of the volume of what the industry produces nationwide. You can't ignore that. That is your cash cow. That's where your product is going. You can't have it be demonized. And it has been in many places. It's been blamed for a lot of things, and that's not true. There's a lot of nutrition in enriched grains. There's the folic acid fortification, which is a wonderful public health initiative that's reduced birth defects and given people an opportunity to have a diet that's supplemented by low-cost, nutritious food that they like. And that's the other side of the equation with the whole grains. All the wonderfulness of whole grains is hard to translate into kids. Kids find whole grains challenging to eat, which is in part why some of the work around the whole white flour area has some potential movement that is exciting, because it's a bit more palatable to kids. But there's story after story after story of kids, you know, backing away from whole grains because they just don't like it. It has a little bitterness to it, a nuttiness to it, a crunchiness to it that kids typically don't get excited about, but they love the smooth, white, soft bread. And so being able to identify there's still nutrition, there's still good things about the refined wheat products, the enriched wheat products, you know, we believe the industry has something to offer for everyone and that those products all have a place.
Now, I have been overseas in places like Indonesia, Vietnam, and I've often wondered, what about establishing a wheat foods-like organization in those countries that are, at this point, so dependent upon rice?
Well, that's always an interesting question. I spent 14 years running the U.S. Potato Board, the marketing group for the potato industry, and we looked at that same question. You know, could we get the 1.3 billion Chinese people to eat potatoes? And you can. The ones who have the resources and who want to experience a Western dining meal, which happens a few times in a year. But most of the time, they eat their local cuisine. And what we concluded after working at it for a while was the best approach to gaining market share and to growing familiarity with a foreign product in a country like that was to incorporate your food into their local cuisine. And so we worked to find chefs and restaurant chains who would experiment, in this case with potatoes, and how do they go into the Chinese dishes? How do they go into the traditional cooking? Sure, you can go get the burger and fries, you can have a Western meal experience in China, and that's a thing people like to do occasionally, but most of the time they're eating that local cuisine.
So soft white wheat is thought of as a sweet wheat, a dessert wheat. Lots of products made with soft white wheat, which is our predominant wheat in the state of Washington, go into sweet products. I have been reading articles recently that sugar is the next demon. Tell me, is that on your radar screen?
Well, it certainly is, Scott. I mean, sugar is an area of question as you look at public health initiatives. As you know, our government dietary guidelines want to look to deal with obesity, particularly childhood obesity. You can look at what's gone on with the soda companies and the candy companies. You know, sodas have been taken out of school. There's a lot of question around the marketing of those products, the breakfast cereal marketing. Sugar definitely is on the radar screen from those who want to move public health into a more positive place. So certainly, as you said, a lot of our products end up being in an indulgent category. And I strongly believe, having spent a lot of time in the food marketing world, is that you can eat any food. I mean, Oprah came out recently talking about how she loved bread but lost 26 pounds eating bread, and now she's a part owner of the Weight Watchers company. That approach to dieting has always been the one that really is scientifically valid. You have to be able to do a couple of things to manage your weight successfully. One is to do something that you can sustain. You know, for a short time, you might be able to tolerate a diet that allows you to lose weight, but if you hate it, you're going to fall off of it. You can't continue to eat a way that just doesn't work for you. And the other thing is, it's really about managing your total caloric intake and your lifestyle. And so it isn't that if I just quit eating the sugar, it's if I quit eating 3,500 calories a day, it doesn't matter where they come from. You know, you have to get that caloric intake. You know, it's the bank account principle. If you put in more than you take out, you build a deposit. Great if it's your bank account, little problem if it's your waistline.
I've talked about this with others, and in this meeting we've been having today, about the fact that Washington exports 90% of its wheat, and yet we are also a member of the Wheat Foods Council and have been since its beginning, I believe. Our wheat is being sold to consumers outside of the United States. What benefit does the Wheat Foods Council have for us?
Well, I'm a strong believer that it's, you know, as an industry, having worked for several industry groups, it's what happens to the whole industry that matters, because you're not on an island. Yes, your wheat is going to Asia because you happen to be on the West Coast, but you're also competing in a global marketplace. There is a price for wheat. If wheat demand is under pressure, there's a problem for Washington growers. Their wheat will become worth less no matter where it's going. And there's the flip side of it too. You know, and same story happens in potato industry or any other industry. The West Coast ships products to Asia. That's how our markets have developed. There's a great track record of that export growth. Meanwhile, other parts of the country sell in the domestic market. And they have often asked the opposite question. Why does the industry fund export marketing? My products don't go there. My products go to New York City and they go to Chicago. And I would rather see my marketing go there. Well, if your products aren't going to Asia and they're staying home and they're going to Chicago and New York City, then those compete with the other parts of the country and help push the price down because there's too much supply. The reverse is true. If the export markets, as we know, are volatile, they depend a lot on exchange rates, they depend a lot on transportation costs and other things. If we see demand for wheat products in the U.S. going backwards, it's going to affect every grower. It doesn't matter what state they're from, doesn't matter what class of wheat they're growing. they're going to have an effect from a demand pullback. And so the rising tide does lift all boats, and we do need to work to get every market that we possibly can.
I'll admit it, I have a soft spot for hard white wheat. How can I not? If hard white was a baseball team, it would be the Chicago Cubs, before they won the World Series. Introduced in 1992 as a class that was expected to replace hard red winter wheat in a few years, hard white has suffered a series of unfortunate events over the years, along with some important victories. I asked Sean Campbell of U.S. Wheat Associates to describe hard white production in the U.S. today.
Currently, the United States grows between 600,000 to 900,000 metric tons of hard white every year, most of it under contract for the domestic market.
And who is taking this wheat?
Mostly domestic mills. One of the big buyers is Ardent Mills, but a couple of the other smaller mills also have programs where they buy off the free market.
And I understand that there are premiums involved in hard white.
Yeah, the premium structure changes year to year depending upon the supply, but usually a grower can depend on a good 5 to 15 cents a bushel premium for growing hard white under contract.
Why is it that Ardent, the largest flour miller in the United States, put such a value on hard white and they're paying premiums over hard red winter, and yet hard red winter is still the big boy on the block?
Well, a big part of what Ardent has found is certain varieties of hard white can create very high quality flours, especially when you talk about the whole wheat market. Now with the whole wheat, even though we've gotten to enjoy our whole wheat products, we really do still like a white product. So using a hard white wheat allows for a much more white whole wheat product.
So the domestic market is taking off. What about the overseas market?
The overseas market, there's a lot of demand there, but unfortunately we just do not have the supply at this time to give them a consistent product.
But Kansas had an incredible crop this year. We don't have the supply?
Kansas had a crop that was about twice as big as normal thanks to the record yields in that state. Unfortunately, it's difficult to build a program off a one-year jump in yields because you have to make sure you have a consistent supply from year to year in order for our customers to start a product line that they'll then sell to their customers.
How close are we to having the production to begin exporting, the so-called critical mass?
We're getting closer, that's for sure. One of the important things that we'll have for that to work, though, is some free market non-contracted hard white.
Explain that to me.
We'll have to have stuff on the open market where, similar to the other wheat classes, you can kind of trade it as a commodity. Right now, most of the hard white is contracted a year prior to it being grown, which then really isn't free to use on the export market.
Any predictions when large-scale exports might happen? Are we going to wait another 20 years?
I certainly hope not. I believe that we're starting to move down the right route to open up hard white more as a commodity and to allow growth in the production that will make it a more consistent supply in the future.
We already have one long-term overseas purchaser of hard white. Nigeria took 32,000 tons in 2015-16 marketing year, and they've been taking large tenders for more than a decade. Why are they the bright spot in overseas exports?
There's a certain mill in Nigeria that has partial ownership of an export terminal in the Texas Gulf. And using that connection, they're able to reach in and snatch up pieces of hard white that they want. As well, the Nigerians have been showing a willingness to take maybe lower quality, not necessarily by test weight or milling quality, but just a little more mix of red wheat in with white wheat, as well as lower proteins than what the domestic market is usually willing to take.
I understand that Taiwan has indicated interest in contracting for hard white. That would be huge for the Pacific Northwest. Can you provide an update? And is this a real possibility or just so much talk?
It's always a possibility. I don't know how strong I would call it at this time. There's a lot of difficulties with setting up that kind of program. I mean, just imagine trying to set up any kind of sale where you're on the other side of the world, especially a year ahead of time. It's difficult.
How much hard white has to be produced each year to begin an export program?
Really, you get 100 different numbers, you ask 100 different people, but I would say you need to get somewhere in the line of about 2 million tons, something close to what we see in Durham today.
That's it for this edition of Wheat All About It. I hope you enjoyed the show. By the way, the commonality between O'Connor and Campbell, it was reflected in O'Connor's comment about all U.S. wheat sales raising everybody's boats, whether it's for domestic market or export. In the end, that's the goal of all of us who work for your wheat industry. Thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Scott Yates, hoping you'll listen to more Wheat All About It!
You think we're simple, you think we're not right. Look at your cities and ask yourself who's right. We've got country and you've got crime. We've got green and you've got grime. Let there be no doubt, we have what it takes to till the soil until our back aches. Just give us a break and don't be so rude. We love the work and you love the food.
We feed you.